made it through his very, very long day in yeshiva. So, kol hakavod, don't smile too brightly. Okay, every day is as long as this day, so just do it again tomorrow. So that's what yeshiva is about. Then you want to find another place to be. Oh my goodness. Okay, so we have a small little group tonight. I'm sure it's just anti-climax to what Shechter spoke about, I'm sure. But the show must go on. So this is the show going on. So we've been trying to identify the thesis of every parsha, the main thrust, one of the key messages we saw in Vayera, the thrust of Avram struggling with his particularistic identity and his universalistic agenda. How could he have a bris milah and still be the Avamon Gayim? And the Lech Lecha, we saw the transition from Avram before the bris to Avraham after the bris. In Chayisara, we witness the recoil of Avram back to the domestic world of being a hero in his own family, not just setting history on fire and changing the world. What's really happening in Toldos, in the broader scheme? So Toldos, of course, is the Parsha of Yitzchak. And before we even read five words in the Parsha, something's up, something strange. Source number one, part Aleph. Ve'ela, Toldos, Yitzchak ben Avram. So finally ready to hear a little bit about Yitzchak. Avram's been buried, has his three parshios, Lech Lecha, Vayera, Chayisara. Yaakov's on the horizon. Now's time for Yitzchak to shine. What do we hear about Yitzchak? Avram, holy is Yitzchak. He was born to Avram. Can you imagine if on your tombstone, when you were buried, they said, this was his accomplishments. He was his father's son. That's all. What did I do? Like, what did I accomplish in this world? So the entree into Yitzchak's world of Toldos is prefaced and framed by his being the son of Avram. Avram Holodis. And we know that already. We knew this already from the beginning of the end of Lech Lecha already. We know this, that he's going to have a child named Yitzchak. It's not like this is a news flash to anyone. Yitzchak's now married to Rivka. And we lived through the birth and through the bris milah, and he was almost killed in that Akedah. So this obviously is not, there's nothing fresh here. So there's a stylistic point, not just a content-driven point. And the truth is, this introduction causes us to take some pause and think about the overall feel of Parshas Toldos, the overall feel of Yitzchak's life. In Sefer Bereishis, names are not just iconic, but they have mission and purpose, and they suggest, remember, Bereishis is about carving out both religious history and Jewish history, and every name participates in those two parallel trajectories. So Avram transitions into Avraham, Avhamon Goyim. Sarai transitions into Sarah. Yaakov has two names, and unlike Avram, for whom the first name is basically discharged and ignored, for Yaakov there's an interplay between the name Yaakov, which connotes the name of struggle, holding on to a heel, circumventing Esav, Yadoch Hezes Bekez Esavak, Verinizet Bamayim, as opposed to the name ultimately Yisrael, which he receives in Parshas Vayishlach, which implies triumph and success, Kisarisa, Imelokim, Vanashim, Batuchal. And these are the two names that are reflective of two different trajectories in Jewish history. There are times that Jews triumph, and there are times that Jews struggle. And Yaakov is a name that captures the struggle of Jewish history, which we're nearing the end of. And Yisrael connotes the point of Jewish history when we triumph. Matovu Ohalecha Yaakov, Mishkinosecha Yisrael. For thousands of years, we didn't have Mishka. We only had Olim, temporary places of residence and temporary countries, and now we're slowly but surely reaching that stage of Mishkin Osecha Yisrael. So the name Yaakov and Yishmael and all the names Rachel and Leah, and we'll see this in Mitzvah Shem in a very, very powerful fashion in Parshas Vayetze. All the Shvatim have names to connote Hashem, hearing the tefillos and responding to the plight of the mothers, and just shutting down my phone. And you'd expect Yitzchak's name to be similar. Yet Yitzchak's name has nothing to do with his life and little to do with his mission. In fact, source number base, Vayipol Avraham va'apana va'Yitzchak. He laughs at the news. Now his laugh is a laugh of joy and excitement, and Sarah's laugh is the laugh of skepticism, and the people who witness Yitzchak's ultimate birth are also happy because, as I mentioned in Parshas Vayera, one of the Shirim, there's a general return to welfare. Women had gone barren. It was a cursed world, and now that Yitzchak was born, many of the women found their own fertility and their ability to nurse. So, Kol Shemei Yitzchakli, and everyone was happy. Yeah, but it has nothing to do with Yitzchak. Can you imagine if your parents called you smiley face because everyone was happy when your birth was announced? Like, you'd expect your name to be personal, about you. And Yitzchak's name has nothing to do with his life and everything to do with the response of everyone around him to his life. Well, what about me? Can't I just have my own name? Yitzchak's asking. Do I deserve a name? Keep in mind, everyone in Sefer Bereishis has two names. Avram, Avraham. Yaakov, Yisrael. Even Yosef, who doesn't have a divinely inspired second name, has a whole bunch of nicknames. Avreich and Safnas Paneach. So everyone's transitioning. Everyone's revolutionizing the world's consciousness, and the names are changing to reflect that, except for good old Yitzchak, who has one name, and even that name isn't his name. It's the name of everyone laughing, scoffing, happy, sad, skeptical, who knows what, when he's born. So here you have someone with a name that isn't his, an introduction that isn't his, and quite frankly, he gets shortchanged in the calculus of Sefer Bereishis. Because if we calculate Sefer Bereishis, which begins with Lech Lecha, because pre-Lech Lecha is prehistory, Avram has three parshios: departure, revelation, and domesticity. Those are the three words that we've tried to internalize the last 3 weeks. Lech Lecha, departure. Vayera, revelation. Chayesara, domestic heroism. Yaakov has six parshios. Vayetzev, Vayishlach, Vayetzev, Miketz, Vigash, Vayechi, the saga of Yaakov and his family, but him at the center of it, unfurls over six parshios. Yitzchak has one parsha. So, he doesn't have a name change. He introduced as Avram's son, and he has one small parsha. And if you read the parsha, excuse me for saying it, it's a pretty boring parsha. If you're looking for epic drama, if you're looking for all the excitement of the parshas before and the parshas after, namely the dreams, the angels, the wars, the kings, prophecies. I mean, this is classic Lech Lecha, Vayera, Vayetze, Vayishlach. You've got Malachim, you've got mountains, you've got a Kaddish Baruch Hu, you've got nighttime dreams and apparitions. I mean, it's classic Shakespeare. I mean, this is high drama, except in Parshas Toldos. There's no wars, there's no battles, there's no face-offs, there's no treaties, there's no internationalism. It's very, very pedestrian. So not only does Yitzchak have only one Parsha, he has a very, very uneventful Parsha. Very little happening in Parshas Toldos. And even as one Parsha, if we're honest with ourselves, he really only has one scene. And we'll take a look at that scene. Because the beginning of the parsha is dominated by Rivka, who has two twins in her, in a very gynecologically graphic description, but that just centers it on Rivka. They begin davening, but the scene pans to Rivka in the gynecologist's office, or then she goes next door to the Rebbe's office saying, Lama zanochi, v'telchid rosh elokim. And then while Yitzchak is off stage, all of a sudden his birthright gets re-engineered over a plate of lentils. And then, of course, the famous scene of Parshas Toldos, he's physically, visually impaired, but it's more than just the visual impairment, but he's essentially a pawn being manipulated by his two sons and his wife. So all he really has is one scene, is one Parsha, no drama, and even within that Parsha, he's only propelling one scene. And we'll talk about that scene in a moment. And the fact that his name doesn't change is an incidental. There's no reason for it to change because it's nothing dramatic. For everyone else, the name change just shows a transition from one chapter in your life to another chapter, generally a transition based on struggle, based on trial, based on adversity. Yitzchak's lack of a name change is because there really is no trial, there's no crucible, there's no transition that he undergoes. So here's a man whose name isn't his, with one parsha, within which he barely authors the parsha, doesn't undergo a name change. But finally, he's got one scene. So at least let's take a look at this one passage in which Yitzchak can shine And you'll see, oddly enough, the exact same phenomena occurring before your very eyes. Vayira of Baretz. Okay, he's finally ready. This is his. He's been training for this in Avos school. He went to Avos school, got a doctorate in being an Av. Doesn't have too much time on his hand. Everyone else is busy dominating Sefer Bereishis. But now's my time to be an Av. How does an Av handle a famine? But right there and then, the Torah chimes in. Source Gimel. Vayira of Baretz. Melvad Harav Harishon Asher Hayabim Avram. He doesn't even have his own famine. Can I get my own famine? What does it take to buy my own famine? This is my famine. Stop calling it part two of Avram's famine. Melvad Harav Harishon Asher. Can it just be my famine? I know I'm not going to have kings and angels and events, but let it just be my famine. Let's have one little parsha that I don't have to be just the second fiddle or the wingman to my father Avram. Okay, you can't always buy your own famine. Sometimes you have to excel at other people's famines, you know? It's not even your famine. It's the sequel to Avram's famine. But he has to find food, and it's a little pressure because the locals may attack his wife and abuse his wife, so he's got to find a solution. What solution do you think he comes up with? He wants to be original. Let me see. Let me come up. Maybe I'll say she's my sister. Where have we seen that before? What do you borrow? Plagiarizing plot, you know, plot plagiarism. Can he come up with his own idea? Maybe, I don't know, say she's my great aunt or hide her in a box or something. Well, Avram tried that according to Rashi, and Yaakov will try that with Dina, but something. Yeah, maybe something. I don't know. Dress up as something. You dress. So it's not even his famine. And he plays the same trick. And this unfolds a little bit later now. We're in a little bit later in Parachavav into some hostility between Yitzchak and Avimelech. And that's interesting how Avimelech is converted from a friend to an adversary. It's an important transition in the general. I write an article every week about Eretz Yisrael and the Parashas. This week's article will be published tomorrow in some of the newspapers, one in New Jersey, one in Brooklyn. So this one is going to be called, a little promo, is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Avimelech. Seems like there are two different Avimelechs. There's the friendly Avimelech in Parshas Vayera, and then in the beginning of this Parsha, and then there's Mr. Hyde Avimelech, who gets very angry at Yitzchak and expresses his hostility, and there's a lot of tension. So part of the point I mentioned, it's very briefly, it's a sidebar, you can read the article if you'd like, is that the Jews have two agendas. Jews have one agenda to introduce important ideas to this world, religious ideas, and the interface between religion and life, and that Hashem wants people to prosper, and Jews have always been at the forefront of advancing society, science, technology, culture, art, the Jewish contribution, and that the world is very excited about. We're happy that the Jews improve our world. And Avimelech is the epitome of that. Avimelech has his world improved, and he signs treaties with Avram, and he appreciates Avram's religious message, and he's Baal Bris Avram, and they form the first city called Be'er Sheva, the first real Israeli city that the Jew has a hand in authoring. But then there's a second agenda. And that second agenda is we have to live in this country to broadcast that message. Hashem wants our message not just to be broadcast from Great Neck and New Rochelle and Plainview, but he wants it to be broadcast from this country as we are aligned underneath Kisei HaKavod. And our second agenda, which complements the first agenda, is to broadcast it from Eretz Yisrael. That agenda the world isn't so excited about. They're very, very happy to embrace the Jewish message and to have their world improved by Jews. But when it's a question of actually assisting the Jewish people in settling their land, then it becomes contentious. And that's the shift in Avimelech. As long as Avimelech is just signing treaties and Avraham's is a guest and he's hosting him and he's being hosted by Mamre. But when Yitzchak becomes a farmer, not just a nomadic shepherd, and he establishes roots and he builds a home, then already Avimelech turns sour. And you see today, even ironically, there's so many people in this world who are thrilled to accept Israeli technology and Jewish developments and Jewish sense. When it comes to our program to settle our land, they get very, very... It's very interesting. I'm sorry to take a sidebar to a sidebar, but last year I was in Cape Town for a speaking conference, and Cape Town is suffering a terrible, terrible drought. I mean, really terrible drought. People, they were threatening to actually turn off the water faucets in Cape Town, South Africa, to literally turn off the faucets and have people collect their water. But terrible, terrible. In any event, So at a certain point, they wanted to buy desalination technology from Israel, and would have rescued the entire city from a civic disaster. And at some point, I don't know the details, but the local town council voted against it, or actually repealed the decision that had been taken to purchase it, because Cape Town is ground zero, South Africa is ground zero for a BDS and anti-Israel sentiment for all sorts of reasons. And they felt like we can't purchase Israeli technology if we're opposed to them politically. Now, I'm not happy that they're opposed to Israel, but it did show me a certain degree of intellectual and moral integrity that we can, on the one hand, enjoy Israeli technology and then oppose them. And reminded me of the odd and bizarre dichotomy that so much of the world faces, that they're excited about how Jews change their world in science, technology, culture, but when the Jewish people want to settle their land, that already creates a stir. So it's interesting to see the transition in Avimelech. But getting back to Yitzchak, because those were sidebars. So now Yitzchak and Avimelech have these challenges, and Avimelech's avadim have closed up, have sealed the wells that were so important to Avram. And now source number Dalet, Vayashav Yitzchak Vayachpar es Be'eros Hamayim Asher Chafru B'mei Avram Aviv. So what would you do if you're Yitzchak? You'd go find some new wells. And yet he goes and redigs his father's wells. Vayisimun Plishtim Achrei Bots Avram. And then he calls the wells names and at least show some individuality and personal creativity, because remember, naming, especially in Sefer Bereishis, it's not just arbitrary that you Google a name. Naming is very precalculated. Adam HaRishon names every animal, and Chazal sensed this as wasn't just random, I'll just pick names off of a list and I'll call this animal a lion, but he understood the essence of every animal and created a name in Hebrew that reflected that essence, and when you name places in Eretz Yisrael. So here is his chance. Even though he's not digging new wells and he's following in his father's footsteps, literally, but yet the pasuk continues, source number Dalet, Vayikra lehem shemos kashemos asher kar lehem aviv. Calls them the same names. So this phenomena repeats itself again and again and again. The submergence of Yitzchak's identity within Avram's identity. And remember I told you HaKadosh Baruch Hu has very little communication with Yitzchak as opposed to the constant communication with Avram and ultimately Yaakov? There's this one moment in the middle of Perek Chavav where HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivers to Yitzchak these brachos. Remember, Yitzchak had never been spoken to. Even at the Akedah, Yitzchak wasn't spoken through all the communication streams to Avram. So this is really the only time HaKadosh Baruch Hu speaks to Yitzchak that's recorded. Hashem tells him, Gur Baretz Hazos, source number Beis, in the Gimel in the middle, Vayem Chavir Rechaka. So finally, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is delivering brachos to Yitzchak, and there's something dramatic, something history-shaping. And Hashem closes the pasuk, Vavarechacha, Kilacha, Ulazaracha, Etein, Eskol, Haratzo, Sael, Vahakimosi, Es Hashavua, Asher Nishbati, Lavra Mavicha. So he doesn't even warrant or merit his own shavua. I'll uphold the shavua that I delivered to Avraham. Okay, you could say HaKadosh Baruch Hu is just extending it. Obviously, it starts with Avraham. But it gets even more compelling. Look at Pasuk Hey, which is bold-faced and underlined. Why are you receiving the shavua? Because of the Akedah? Because of your tefillah? Because of your amunah? No. Ekev, Asher, Shama, Avraham, Bikuli. You're getting it because of Avraham. Anochi Elokei Avram Avicha. A little bit later, Hashem appears to him at night. This is only in contact. Al tira ki itcha anochi. Uverachticha. Virabesi azaracha. Bavur Avraham Avdi. So even this one little section, which is really the only Yitzchak section in a small parsha. The famine is part two of Avram's famine. The solution is Avram's failed solution. The wells that he digs are Avram's wells. The names that he confers are the same names. And all the promises and oaths that he receives are Avram's oaths. Ekev Hashoshim Avram Bikoli, Bavur Avram Avdi. So you walk away from this parsha asking yourself, what happened to Yitzchak? He's the disappearing man. I thought there were three avos. Seems like there's only two. Because Yitzchak has absolutely no role, no name, no transition, no drama, nothing epic. And Chazal have a way of conveying this in that very first pasuk. Ela told us Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham olidus Yitzchak. Let's see Chazal's statement, and now you'll realize how resonant the statement is. Source number vav, it's a medrash. Avraham, nikra Avraham. Avraham was called Avraham. You know what else? You know who else was called Avraham? Yitzchak nikra Avraham. Yitzchak was also called Avraham. Shenemar, Ela told us Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham. In fact, if you follow the structure of this sentence, it's called a shift in structure. The shift in structure ultimately places the word Avraham twice. The Torah should read Ela toldos Yitzchak ben Avraham, Yitzchak nolad le'Avraham. That would be the flow. Ela toldos Yitzchak was born. Even if you want to tell me his birthday, so you were born to your father. You were born on. I wouldn't say you were born to your father. Your father gave birth to you on. That's what the pasuk ultimately reads. Ela toldos Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham b'lid Yitzchak. So the literary effect is boom boom Avraham Avraham. The pasuk screams Avraham. So not only does Yitzchak get attributed to Avram, it gets attributed to two Avrams. That's a literary device. It's called enjambment, where you switch the sentence structure. Ela told us Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram, twice Avram. So the question that Parshas told us is, what happened to Yitzchak? Where is Yitzchak in the drama of Toldos and in the larger drama of Sefer Bereishis? There's too much here. From the name, to the famine, to the wells, to the naming of the wells, to the an interaction with Avimelech, what occurs with Yitzchak? Who is Yitzchak and what is his role? Okay, so to understand Yitzchak's role, you need to study a little bit of history. I mean, you find it in many different areas because all of life is structurally symmetrical. What happens in history is reflected in math, what happens in math is reflected in science, and because it's all Hashem's will, so there's going to be repeating patterns, but history is probably the best opportunity here to appreciate it. Many of you have studied the French Revolution. Many of you have studied the American Revolution. Let's say it was election day in America. American democracy is in crisis. So it's a good chance to remind what happened 250 years ago. Why did the American Revolution more or less succeed? And the French Revolution not only failed, but led to a regression, led to a political vacuum, to which Napoleon's death and created even more totalitarianism and suffering. The magic of the American Revolution is that freedom fighters and rebels were able to transition into statesmen. At a certain point, they said, let's stop the revolution, and now let's entrench these ideas and create a constitution and diplomacy, and at a certain point, the revolution ended. And that's no small feat. And by contrast, the French Revolution was a revolution that never yielded a subsequent period of stabilization and entrenchment. It was just a revolution that constantly revolved. And today's revolutionaries were tomorrow's victims. And Robespierre was guillotined. Jean-Paul Marat was ultimately stabbed in his bathtub. And the revolution constantly cycled. And in life, you've got these bursts, these supernovas of great new ideas that enter the human sphere and the human realm. And they radically revolutionize human thought and experience. But those can only be successful if they're followed by periods of stability and entrenchment in which these ideas can trickle down into human consciousness and into human identity. Because if today's revolutionary idea is just replaced by a quick, rapid, subsequent revolution, then nothing really gains traction. Everything is just ideas swirling, replacing one another, and subverting each other. It all leads to subversiveness. And that's what happens in the French Revolution as opposed to the American Revolution. The American Revolution, for whatever reason, whether they're better statesmen or not, it happens to be, as a historical anecdote, that a lot of the American revolutionaries were also very thoughtful people. So even though they pressed into a rebellious role, it wasn't the rule of the mob as it seems to have been in the French Revolution. Being led, the mob was led by people, thoughtful people, trying to articulate a new form of a government, a new form of morality. And so in a sense, we have to try to associate this change with great new ideas, as I think we should in Eretz Yisrael. We feel that the return to Medinas Yisrael and the construction of a state of Israel, again, within both spheres, both within the Jewish realm and as well within the international realm, 1948 should be a turning point in history. What great new ideas do we want to introduce? I feel that we're introducing democracy, equality, justice into the Middle East, which is, in and of itself is a major, experientially, aside from the military and political issues, from a human standpoint, is an important change to try to create a model for our neighbors of how to create just societies and societies of fairness and respect for human life, which of course hasn't yet taken hold, but something that we're trying desperately to exhibit to people around us. And that's really Yitzchak's role. And it takes a lot of strength not to be revolutionary, because revolutions are always exciting. They're always thrilling. They're enchanting. It's always exciting to breathe the fresh air of change and to break down institutions and rebuild them from scratch and see yourself as a pioneer and the revolutionary spirit and Che Guevara and holding up the scepter of change and innovation. And sometimes it takes a lot more inner strength just to live a boring life without constant change and swirl, and just to live ideas deeply and consistently and continuously. Sometimes it takes more strength because that sweet toxin of change isn't available to drive your experience. You just have to have discipline and deeper vision and deeper conviction. And without Yitzchak, there is no Parsha Sefer Bereishis. If Yitzchak reinvents Avram's wheel, then we're back to square one. Excuse the mixed metaphor between wheels and squares. We're back to square one. Avram had so many bold ideas he introduced, which again we take for granted because we live in Avram's world. So it's hard for us to appreciate how many ideas Avram introduced. Reason, science, religion, monotheism, morality. I mean, so many. Of course, and then within religion, Yiras Hashem, Avas Hashem, observance, commandments. So much that Avram introduced. Now it had to trickle down to Yitzchak, his family. There seems to have been an entourage of people who weren't genetically related to our Avos who still were spreading these ideas. And Nefesh HaShasu Becharan, maybe some of Avram's children from Keturah. It's hard to know where these people lived and who they were. They're not recorded in the Torah. But evidently it wasn't just that Yitzchak, Rivka, Yaakov, and Esau, four people, are going to absorb these ideas. But the ideas are cascading through human identity and through public consciousness. And for Yitzchak, he doesn't have to really live a life of drama, of travel, of encounter, of angels, of apparitions, of name changes. He doesn't have to have a new bold name. He doesn't have to have a new famine. And of course, the images of the wells are so powerfully iconic because digging a well is essentially creating presence and identity and ideas, especially in ancient agricultural society. Digging a well is a very, very symbolic moment. And digging is life providing. It's like an occupation. And digging a well, he just redigs the well. So that captures Yitzchak's function, Yitzchak's role. He just wants to dig the wells of his father and name them the same names and entrench and solidify and consolidate the achievements of Avram. There's a beautiful netziv in the introduction to a sefer, a very, very voluminous introduction. The netziv wrote a sefer on the shildos of Rav Haigon, and it's called the Himek Sheila. It's a huge, huge sefer, but if we get a chance, we'll try to read some of it in Mitzvah Shem this year. And he gives an introduction, the history of Talmud Torah. How did Torah unfold? Not just who taught whom, but or the different geists that drove the unfurling of Torah, the different spirits and movements. And essentially, obviously summarizing a 50-page introduction, but one of his thrusts is that Torah cycles and rotates between periods of great creative development followed by periods of entrenchment where the development and creativity of the previous era have to now be categorized, collated, organized so that people can appreciate them and internalize them. So, for example, just starting with the days of the Tanaim, the second half of the second Beis HaMikdash, stretching, let's pick 350 BCE. So we're talking about probably 500 years of unparalleled creativity. I used the word supernova before. It's like a burst. Hillel, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and Rabbi Akiva, and Rav Meir, and the Tanaim, Yudan Nasi, Rav Shmuel, Rav Nachman, Rav Sheshe Zabaya. I mean, I don't know there was ever a concentration of such intellectual and spiritually driven. Just it was a perfect moment, a perfect storm. And then, more or less around the year 500, the period of the Gaonim commences, and we don't really have too many chidushim of the Gaonim, because they didn't see their role primarily to reinvent the wheel. They were working over these newly published texts called Mishnah and Gemara, finding the right girsa, comparing them to Tosefta's, writing Sidurim, Ramam Gaon, articulating some of the basic ideas of Emunos Videos, of Jewish theology that weren't concretely available through Shas. So if you wanted to know how to pick up a lulav, open up the Gemara and Sukkah. You wanted to know what do we believe in, what are the tenets and theological beliefs, it's hard. You can get them from Shas, but it takes a lot of work. So besides, you're going to put together Emunos Videos. But it's summarization. Obviously, there's creativity in any form of processing. But it's summarizing and articulating and collecting. Now it's the year 1000. And all that information has been crystallized and distilled. Now they've been shown him. The Rabbeinu Hananel, the Rif, the Rambam, the Rashba, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, the Rashma, Rami Rottenberg. And again, this burst of creativity. Comparing the Gemara to the Gaonim. Are the Gaonim right? And some Rishonim were very pro-Gaonim, and some Rishonim were very anti-Gaonim. And questions that were left unattended to in the Gemara, maybe earlier generations were implicitly. Now we have to articulate them with greater methodology and greater categorical thought. And now it's the 16th century, and Rabbi Yosef Cairo writes the Sefer. It's essentially collating. It's the classic collation. He's anti-creativity to a degree. He's saying you shouldn't paskin based on your read through the sugya. Here's the formula to paskin. Take every sugya, put into the number cruncher. Who holds what between the Rosh, the Rambam, and the Rif? 2 out of 3 majority will rule like. And for 200-300 years, people dedicated their time and their energy to trying to collect the Beis Yosef, organize, solve questions on the Beis Yosef. So if you're living in the 1600s, no one, and I mean no one, hardly anyone is writing a Sefer on Shas. There is a paradigm shift. Now it's right. If your name is Shapsi Cohen and you're living in Poland, you're going to write a Sefer on Shulchan Aruch. What are you going to call it? The Shach. And you were the greatest Talmudic mind of your period, but you're writing on Shulchan Aruch. Of course, you're dabbling in all the Rishonim, but your starting point is to ask a kashya in the Shulchan Aruch and essentially clean up the Shulchan Aruch. Do you agree with this Pesach? Do you not agree with this Pesach? Taz, Magen Avraham, the Shach. And now all of a sudden you start to segue to the early part of the late part of the 18th century, early part of the 19th century, and then you have a cycling back. And for us, probably, again, we're not talking about the world of Hasidus that we'll talk about in the morning, starting tomorrow, but certainly the world of Gemara learning and Halacha, Reb Chaim and Volozhin and all of Reb Chaim's Talmidim, and of course that fuels the explosion of the Yeshiva movement. Remember the Yeshiva movement, since we're thinking a little bit over the next 24 hours about the difference between Ashkenazic Jewry and Sephardic Jewry, the Yeshiva movement really didn't affect Sephardic Jewry, for better or for worse. The Yeshiva movement has a lot of tremendous firepower that it provided in Torah thrust, but it also creates issues that we helpfully think about, do we? And when you look at Sephardic Jews, you're essentially looking at Judaism circa 1800, before the Yeshiva. You're looking at the way Judaism was, because they've retained, again, for better or for worse, they're more or less a mirror image of who they were, just updated with dress and location. And Ashkenazic Jewry is barely recognizable to what it was in 1800, and primarily, a lot of factors, but primarily the Yeshiva movement, of course, secularization, reform, Judaism, which also didn't affect the Sephardic world. So, and if you ask me now, I like to say the two most important sperm written in the latter half of the 20th century, what am I going to say? The Rav, the Lichtenstein, Rav Amital. The two most important sperm written in the latter half or in the 20th century in general is Kahati and Artscroll. When you really think about it, if you really parse the numbers, Kahati and Artscroll have made Torah available to millions of people for whom Torah would otherwise be inaccessible. And of course, when I say Artscroll and Kahati, I mean that whole genre, whether it's the Bar Ilan Shoot, whether it's various websites, essentially collecting, collating, and enabling, providing. There's no great chidushim, but just. And I think that's how I think we see ourselves in our day, and I think it's how I see myself. I don't necessarily have to go ahead and recreate a sugya. I want to take the ideas that have been expressed and organize them for people to be able to recreate the patterns and to understand the inner logic and maybe articulate in a language and maybe people who haven't had base medrash When I decided to start writing these Talmudic methodology shiurim 25 years ago, that's basically my target. I wanted to take people who were intelligent and who just were unable to appreciate what they saw as the gibberish of Shas. They had an yeshiva background. How can I take this whole beautiful world that we live in, that I live in, offer it to them in a way that will excite them and will retain their belief and affiliation with Chazal and Torah Shebaal Peh? That was the birth of the shiurim that I'm writing. So that's Yitzchak's glory. And that's Yitzchak's heroism. And since we don't have too much time, I'll just say that that's something I want you to think about in life. I want you to think about, I'll be very brief about it, both macro and micro. Macro, because there are different stages in your life. There are stages of Avram, there are stages of Yitzchak. There are stages of great discovery and expansion and spreading your wings. And by and large, you're in that stage right now. I have to tell you, one of the things I enjoy about teaching kids your age is I just have such fond and powerful memories from my years of 18 to around 25, 26. I just have this, almost like a flavor, like an ice cream flavor. I can't even describe it. But growth and development and meeting people and developing your identity and forging whom you are and just spread. It's just such a beautiful time to be alive. It's such a beautiful time to have your health and your Baruch Hashem, all the resources you have, and to use that to become who you'll be. But at a certain point in life, you have to transition into Yitzchak. And you see people who have a hard time making that transition. The Peter Pan effect, where it's just they're 40 years old and they still just don't get it. And they're constantly on the run and constantly changing and moving and new hobbies and new people and new places. And for some people, it inhibits their marriage or inhibits their professional advancement. They always have to change because they're afraid of boredom and they're afraid of, and there's actually a modern word for it, ennui, which is a psychological state of boredom. And it takes great discipline and inner strength just to repeat your steps day in, day out, and to lock in. That's where family is ultimately when you settle down. And sometimes it transitions. It isn't bright lights and excitement and change and think of the people who sometimes live in large urban cities like New York City. There's an excitement that comes from the rush of humanity and seeing dozens of people and thousands of people, different colors and different what. That doesn't naturally lend itself to stabilization. Remember, I once spent the Shavuos in the city in New York. I spent Shavuos in different communities. And when I go someplace for Shabbos or for Yom Tov, I like to latch on to the community, to meet the people, to become part of their lives for however long I can, not just to get up and speak, but to be part of a community, to understand their stresses, their goals, their aims, their communal feel, and be part of a community for it. And it just, that was a very hard Shavuos for me because Shavuos was during the week, it wasn't Shabbos. And I literally walked out of shul. And what is it you do when you walk out of shul? You hang around for a little, you talk, you say hello to people, you schmooze, you say a joke. And I walked out of Shavuos right into Midtown Manhattan. And there was just a swish of people. No one could stand. Not like they pushed us away physically, but there was no ability to congregate and to talk peacefully and quietly because you were just thrown into the maddening rush of Midtown Manhattan. It was very jarring for me that I couldn't transition in the way that I wanted to. And you have to have that ability in life at a certain point to accept the boredom, not to fear people, especially in an entertainment-centric culture. Remember, I've told you this before, and I don't want to take too long as I have to go to Meyer, but humanity at large is still recovering from World War I. You may think it's 2018, but it's pretty much 1918. Humanity is still looking for the identity that it forfeited in the First World War. That was the seismic shift. Everything we believed in, monarchy, nobility, courtesy, dignity of the human condition, it all collapsed in World War I, in the trenches in the Western Front. From an existential standpoint, World War I was much more jarring than World War II. World War II was just an evil force, and the world rallied. It was binary. It was black. It was an action movie. And I don't mean to trivialize it. I'm just putting it in your terminology. It's pretty straightforward. The terms we were protecting, terms that were clear to us, and after Hitler was defeated, we could return to the pre-World War II state of freedom and liberty. And again, the only change was the Soviet Union, but more or less. World War I completely washed away old notions and old conventions of identity and didn't really replace it with much. And human beings are still looking, how do I define myself as? What do we live for? I think there are many ideas that have captured the human imagination, for sure. But I don't think that that process has really surged to its conclusion. I think for many people, entertainment is an opiate. I don't have to search for identity if I'm constantly being entertained. I'm constantly watching highlights and constantly watching movies and constantly listening to music. And the great drug lord that delivered this opiate to humanity was Steve Jobs. He was like basically the drug pusher. He says, I'll help you take drugs your whole life. Because you can have endless entertainment, endless movies, and endless, and I'll create the technology. I'll give you the pipe. I'll give you the meth lab to drug yourself into stupor without having to face these issues. That's why he kills him, and people celebrate him. He didn't deliver anything of value to humanity. I'm not opposed to him as a person, but just his contributions in no way enhance the human condition. He gave us the ability to entertain ourselves more. Entertainment is a very peripheral part of our lives to relieve stress. And you have to have that capacity just to deal with not having adventure and excitement. Remember when you were in high school, sometimes you talk to people and they say, remember in high school, let me give you a powerful example, where you were living for the next big event, the next big basketball game or restaurant or trip, or, and you're just biding your time and holding your breath until I get... It's a very sad way to live your life because you are ignoring reality and real time and just collapsing it as a preface into these sporadic or staccato events that you're looking forward to. So it is important at one point in your life to transfer. We have to go to Maariv. I don't want you to miss Maariv, but it's also important in Yeshiva. Now that we're in Cheshvan, it's not Elul, it's not going to be exciting, and every day will not necessarily bring new adventure, although tomorrow will be, as today did, to be able to say, well, I'm a Yitzchak, and Yitzchak doesn't have to be an Avram, and doesn't have to reinvent our conventions. Again, we have to stop this. Maariv is more important. Okay? Shukach, everyone. You're welcome.